At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Welcome back to Travoltine Presents Easy Riders, hosted by Jeff Sweeney and Stuart Elmore, covering Beetlejuice, with special guest Scott Holzer.
Welcome
to
Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice.
All right. Guys.
We blew our load.
We gotta be real careful here.
We blow our load.
It's three times uninterrupted.
We've interrupted.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
Wait. No. It didn't happen. I interrupted.
I heard Beetle.
I interrupt because it's one stream that we're all going through.
Yeah. What counts as an interruption? Is it like a second gap? Is it a minute gap? Is it an hour gap?
I think it's just any syllable spoken between
any other
words. Utterance.
Does it say Beetlejuice?
Wait.
And happy fun go time Beetle.
Yeah. I think
juice.
That's
was interrupted.
Yeah, that's an interrupted.
That's why Michael Keaton to show up.
Right. Well, I need a legal context for this.
What if we brought a lawyer
we
in?
We need to bring a lawyer and talk about the whole parameters of the Beetlejuice.
And now we cut to our resident lawyer.
Right.
Scott Holzer's sister.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome back to Easy Riders, folks. Thank you so much for listening to our episode last week on Square Dance. That's a movie that we talked about.
That is.
It's a movie that real people made that was seen by probably 1 to 2.
And they're both sitting here next to me.
Yes.
That's right.
This is kind of the first big episode that we've had for the series.
Episode 3.
Yeah.
It's very, very typical of thinking about Fraser's beginnings.
Yep. And Travolta.
It's always we start off with two no-name movies.
Winona.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because she, she first got, she was first in Lucas for the small role. Square Dance was her first leading role, but it was,
a very small.
Very small movie.
TV movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was theatrically released, but nobody saw it.
Right.
Made very little money.
Yeah.
But then this is kind of the movie that makes Winona Ryder an icon.
Yeah.
Makes her a celebrity, makes her a movie star.
Yeah.
And then everything we talk about from here on, save for maybe next week's episode, is essentially starting a run of hits.
Yeah.
Even if they're not, popularly received, it's a run of hits for Winona.
Yeah.
A lot of movies that kind of were generation defining. Not for our generation necessarily, but they define, people who grew up in the late 80s, early 90s. And it all starts here with Beetlejuice.
Yeah. It does. 1988, the same year she's going to do 1969, which we'll cover next week. And then in 2 weeks, we'll cover Heathers.
Yes.
All that to say, 1988, what a fucking year.
Good year to be Winona Ryder. Maybe not a great year to be other people, but good year to be Winona Ryder.
Who is it not a good year to be in 1988?
Ronald Reagan saying some things. Oh, the economy's crashing.
The Iran-Contra affair.
The movies for Winona
The movies
Ryder.
Are pretty good.
The movies
good,
were really good.
We don't care about historical context. We care about Hollywood people.
Yeah,
yes,
right.
That's all that matters.
But she was doing back-to-back stuff. It was Lucas in 86, Square Dance 87, and then it's Beetlejuice 1969, Heathers all in 1988. Movie after that. She has a really solid, consistent, prolific streak.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And this is not only kind of a defining movie for Winona.
Yeah.
It's also a defining movie for its director, Tim Burton.
Yeah, very much so.
I rewatched it last night and this morning, and I like the not the, what do you call them? I mean, the practical effects.
Yes.
The actual costumes they put him in. There's this one scene where they're in like their counselor's office, and she's like, "Well, what are you gonna do to scare him?" This is like later in the movie, and he like stretches his face, and she opens her mouth, and I was like, "Oh my!" I was like, "Holy crap!" For the 80s,
it looks
like
incredible.
This looks amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And like the beetle, and like the miniature set that they shot on looks phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Like they did such a good job with not just the costumes and the prosthetics, but also just like the how they actually did the miniature set versus showing everything else around them. It like looks really freaking good.
Yeah. Jeff, was Henry Selick involved in this at all?
Henry Selick was not involved in this.
Interesting.
Okay. Henry Selick is an interesting story that we kind of talked about on the show once.
Yeah.
We might talk about him again in the future. So I'll save that for then, but I want to talk about Tim Burton a little bit.
Yeah.
Because this is his second movie.
Essentially. Yeah.
If you discount like some of his shorts or like the Frankenweenie 20-minute movie.
Yeah, he did like a couple like an episode of some TV stuff, but
yeah. So there was a lot of like random stuff that
random
he was
stuff,
messing
but
around
second
with.
Second movie. Yeah.
Second movie. He starts off with Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Yeah. Is his first movie.
Which has a lot of the similar effects that you're talking about. That kind of are in this movie, but exploded to 11.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure, just like an incredible movie. I love that movie so much. It looks incredible. It's such a mission statement from Burton, just of his style. But there is like a floor of success to a Pee-wee movie.
Yeah.
Not everyone's going to go see a Pee-wee movie.
Yeah.
But still, you know, that movie was very successful off of its budget. It cost $7 million, made $40.
Yeah.
I would consider that a success.
It's a big success. And so Burton is kind of seen as, this guy is going to, he's going to blow up. He's now a live action filmmaker because he spent like a decade working at Disney as an animator.
Yeah.
He's going to be the next big thing. And so he gets a lot of offers about what to direct.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, he gets offered After Hours, which goes on to be a Martin Scorsese movie,
mm-hmm.
Tim Burton would have probably done very differently than Scorsese.
Yeah.
But he, you know, turns that down, and he comes across a script called Beetlejuice. He gets a lot of credit for, like, coming up. He did not come up with the idea of Beetlejuice. He finds the script.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, this is really interesting. This appeals to my interests. This is something I want to do.
Which is funny, because it definitely sounds like, watching it and, like, reading the script definitely makes it look like something he probably would have thought of. Like, just the idea of it alone feels, like, out of Tim Burton's head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It does, and I think that, you know, this kind of defines his, you know, style and sensibility over the next decade. And how much of that comes from him and how much comes from the script as it's presented, which was written by Michael McDowell. Mm. But he's simultaneously working on this and Batman, and Warner Brothers doesn't want to fund Batman at the time because it's going to cost so much money. And so he ends up making this first. And he, you know, messes around, does some involvement on the script, and then finally goes into production. And a big thing he's looking for is he needs someone to play Lydia in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Keaton gets cast after Sammy Davis Jr. turns it down, which would have been a very different movie.
Good pick, though.
But yeah, Keaton, Tim Burton wasn't familiar with him, but then someone showed him to him and he immediately just cast him off of, you know, right away.
Yeah.
They auditioned a lot of young actresses to play Lydia, which is a very important role in the movie. She's arguably the main character.
It's hard to say because I was almost say Alec Baldwin and
Gina Davis.
Gina Davis would be probably the main characters, but Lydia's definitely like right up there with them. But it's almost funny because we don't see Lydia until like, I almost want to say like the
20 minutes in roughly. 20,
yeah. Break into act two essentially. Yeah. And then even then when we're with the family in act two, she's kind of like in the background. It isn't until like halfway through the movie when she really,
it's not until she actually like
gets into the attic.
Right when she really gets into the film is when she's like, they're trying to scare them by putting the bed sheets on them.
Yeah.
And she's like firing off these Polaroids like crazy because she's this black and white photographer, so edgy and whatnot.
Right.
And she picks up the Polaroid and she sees that she's Winona's feet. Like, that's the beginning of when Winona actually starts, you know, that's when she probably
getting
takes
involved
the main
plot.
The main character of what was going on. But up into that, that's like 30 minutes into the film. Like,
yeah,
you maybe have like four lines out of her, and it's always it's like that's about, and it's like this dark thing, and her dad's like, okay, and then moving on.
It's like my life is a dark room, like that.
Yeah,
that's
pretty much
her line.
That's her entire line.
It's her entire line, like for like the first like half of the movie, essentially.
Yeah.
So I would say like Alec Baldwin, Gina Davis are like kind of the leads, but it does shift though.
It's a movie where the focus shifts frequently within its own
absolutely
skeleton.
Yeah.
To use the
which I kind of like, because it's just not following like two characters the entire time. Like they definitely do. I mean, Tim Burton did a great job following every character, like the interior designer that is hired. I love that man so
that's
much.
Otho.
Otho. Okay. Yeah. He's oh my God, his character is so good. And then the mom from Home Alone, I'm blanking on her name right now.
Catherine O'Hara.
Who also played one of my favorite characters from Schitt's Creek.
Mm-hmm. She's so good in this.
Oh my God, she's phenomenal. If you don't let me tear this down, I'm going to get like, oh my God, she's so good in this.
Yeah.
This is, you know, Stuart, this is our third movie in a row where we definitely don't have to talk about any problematic actors.
Yes, we do. The dad.
That's the joke I'm making.
Oh, sorry.
Our first episode.
Clearly, I listened to every single episode of this podcast.
The first movie we covered for Winona, Lucas, starred Charlie Sheen.
Zero problematic right
the
there.
The second one had Rob Lowe playing a mentally disabled character. And now we get a movie with...
Was that back when he was a student addict and doing a bunch of blow?
I think so.
Probably.
Most likely.
Probably.
And this movie has a very chill cast, including Alec Baldwin.
And that's not even the
Jeffrey
one who
Jones,
I was...
Jeffrey Jones, known pedophile.
Oh my God, is that what it is?
Yes.
I don't know
the
Jeffrey Jones stuff.
Jeffrey Jones, so the dad is also the principal from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
I've seen him in a lot of young 80s, 90s
Yeah,
films.
He was huge in that time, but he was like a convicted pedophile.
Oh my
God. You can
God.
Still look him up. He's still on the registry.
Yeah, child pornography, soliciting a 14-year-old to take explicit photos.
Oh my God, he was on set with so many kids.
Yeah, and he's in like every like John Hughes movies, like they're all kids, and he's in several of them.
He's in Ferris Bueller. He's the funniest part of Ferris Bueller.
He is, and it's
why do I feel
which
like
makes that
Home
which
Alone.
Makes that scene of him in the arcade and it's like your ass is mine even fucking creepier.
Yeah.
Like it's just like I rewatched Ferris Bueller the other day because I went as Cameron for Halloween with my friend Kyle, and he was Ferris. And I rewatched it, and when I watched that scene, I was like, oh God, this is so much creepier now that I know about this.
God. I didn't know about the Jeffrey Jones stuff.
Yeah.
It's a double whammy this episode.
Alec Baldwin. Yeah. Very problematic there.
I think this might be the first murderer we've covered on this show.
Oh, hey, he's not convicted.
Manslaughter.
Manslaughter.
Innocent and two proven guilty in this country, people.
They are bringing back charges last time.
They are. There's new evidence that said he actually pulled the trigger. But who
yeah, like,
knows?
I there's really no... Regardless of Alec Baldwin's complicity in actually shooting someone, I'm sure he did not go to set that day intending to shoot someone.
No.
There is the discussion of him being a producer of that movie that is worthy of litigation. And we're not. I'm not going to make any libelous claims.
We're not going to go down this rabbit hole. We're talking about.
I'm just saying, it's definitely the armor and the AD. Like that. That's what it is. It's almost like kind of not. I won't say clear cut, but it's definitely the armor and the AD's like thing.
So Beetlejuice, guys.
Yes.
So Beetlejuice.
So Burton auditions a lot of young actresses in Hollywood for Lydia, including Sarah Jessica Parker, Lori Loughlin, Diane Lane, Molly Ringwald, and Jennifer Connelly. Mm. So it's like
all great actresses, but like I don't think any would have played the role that Winona played.
Yeah.
She played that goth, depressed girl who just wants that attention so well.
Because Winona very much established herself as playing outsiders, and she's already done that twice.
Yeah.
Apparently, Burton goes to see Lucas, and he sees Winona in those scenes. He's like, "That's my Lydia."
Yeah.
And very much wants to cast her off of just seeing that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they go through the audition
process.
Which
we say like seeing that movie is really just seeing her face.
Yes.
Because I was gonna say after you listed all those actors, I thought they would be good. They would be good. They would be good. But Winona's just got the look for Lydia. Like, she just looks like somebody who would just sit at a dinner table with a veil wearing all black and be like, my soul is a dark room. Like, I don't know. Like, it passes off so chill and so easily. You're not even, like, thinking about it. Because you said Jennifer Connelly. I'm like, well, like, I can see a Jennifer Connelly goth, dude. But no, like, Winona just has, like, an appearance.
Just has
to
that
her.
Look.
Yeah.
And apparently at this time in her
it's
life.
It's that resting face that she has sometimes. Like, you see it in Stranger Things, too. Yeah, and maybe. You're just like, yeah, I see it.
Yeah. Something with it.
It's great, though.
Yeah.
Because she, apparently at this time in her life, was actually in a goth phase or an all black phase.
Gotcha.
So that she just showed up to set wearing what she wore.
That's,
hair.
Well, it's funny you say
that's
that.
The big Lebowski move right there.
That's actually kind of what happened. She provided a lot. Once she got the role, which she got in her first meeting, she walked in probably dressed in all black, and Tim Burton was sitting there probably in like wrapped in a cocoon. He was just like, "You're hired."
Yeah.
But she was like, "All right, I need to get into character of Lydia. What would Lydia be like?" And her decision was she was going to start collecting creepy old dolls.
Oh my God.
So what is up with like actors and actresses being like, I have to put my entire life in this role.
Method, baby.
Like, what do you think she did with the dolls after?
I hope it's like that.
She still has them.
Have you ever seen that David Lynch, like Roger Rabbit story?
Yeah.
Remind me.
David Lynch, he like saw a bunch of rabbits off the side of like, the road, just like plush ones, and he's like, well, I can't leave those there, and so he picked them up and he brought them home, and then eventually someone's like, whatever happened to those? And he's like, they were not agreeing with me anymore. Just something very ominous. I'm trying to find the exact quote.
Next time, if we ever get to meet Winona Ryder, the first question I'm going to ask her is, what did you do with the dolls
that you started collecting for Beetlejuice?
And honestly, wouldn't be surprised. She's like, oh, I kept them. And that's how I got in character for Stranger Things. I'd be like, okay, makes sense.
Yeah, she has a doll room.
I found the exact quote to David Lynch. He saw five Woody Woodpeckers plushes on the side of the road. It says, I braked the car dry, turned around, and saved their lives. I named them Chucko, Buster, Pete, Bob, and Dan, and they were my assistants, and I had them in my office. The reporter then later asked, what happened to them? And he said, they are no longer part of my life.
What? What? He has to give a better answer than that.
They're no longer part of my life.
Wow.
But she had all these dolls for this movie.
Yes.
I hope it helped get her into the character. The dolls never make an appearance in the movie.
Right.
But she did, you know, have a lot of input into designing her costume for this movie.
Yeah.
Burton's style of directing at this time is very improv, free-flowing.
Yeah.
So most of what is said there was a script, obviously. But most of what is said in the movie is kind of just the actors riffing off of the situation.
Yeah.
And so that kind of bled into Winona's costume choice, that she would just come to set in, you know, what she thought the character would dress like.
Yeah.
And usually the Tim Burton be like, perfect, exactly, great.
Saves you a lot of hair and makeup time.
Yeah, saves you a lot of hair and makeup time. I'm sure she still went through the works and whatnot.
Yeah.
But, and she, you know, this was the first movie where she's like, I felt great on this set. Yeah. Like, to her, Tim Burton was not what she had associated with directors, mm-hmm. what she had worked with in the past. He was young, he was hip, he was cool. And she was very attracted to that in a, like, in a work sense. That's the kind of person, that's the kind of vibe she wants on set.
This is from her biography?
This is from her biography that I've been reading.
Yeah.
No, Jeff just personally knows Winona.
Yeah, we're good friends. But I have been going, Scott, I bought a biography, and every time for one of our recordings, I just read up to the movie that we're covering. So I have the context, which I didn't have for Brendan or Travolta, because they don't have a biography.
That's a shame. Honestly, you could write their biography. You know enough about
them. In theory, I could write it at this point and make like $5 from people ordering John Travolta A Life off of Amazon.
Dude, you easily could.
Mm-hmm.
No, what you call it is...
Amazon will print it and bind it for you, too.
Oh, yeah, they'll do anything.
What's the name of his book that we read for
Propeller One-Way Night Coach.
You should call his biography Propeller One-Way Night Coach.
Mm-hmm.
The Taking of Propeller One-Way Night Coach.
One of my favorite quotes is her mom talking about how apparently when Winona was sick, she told her she wanted to kill herself to see what was beyond life. Okay. Just because she was like curious. And her mom's like, don't do that.
That reminds me one of my favorite scenes is when she's like, this sounds dark, but when she's writing that suicide note and she goes through like four different adaptations of it and she's like, I have fallen. I have plummeted off the bridge.
Stuart, it is funny because we're doing two episodes slightly out of order for this show, but we are covering two movies about
teenage suicide.
Winona committing suicide today.
Yeah.
This and Heather's.
Very true. Very true. Yeah. I very much, and for, I think a little bit of Tim Burton context into that is this movie, because his career's been kind of scattered, again, like you said, with short films. Pee-wee was in 1983, I think.
Yeah.
This is 1988, so 5-year gap. He'd done some TV episodes.
I like typing Pee-wee into Google. That's always a really satisfying.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure Pee-wee was
85. So there's a 3-year gap between Pee-wee and then Beetlejuice. But after Beetlejuice,
he's working pretty consistently.
He's working very consistently. Batman, Scissorhands, Batman Returns, Ed Wood, and then it just, like, he keeps going back to back on stuff. So his career absolutely, like, just takes off from this movie.
This movie is we'll talk about the end, but this is a massive success.
Oh, yeah.
Especially for him.
Yeah.
But the last few things I want to talk about before we can delve into the movie are the
Michael Keaton context.
Well, the Michael Keaton context is essentially that he just, you know, Burton doesn't know who he is, and then sees him and is like, all right, we're hiring that guy.
Yeah.
Because he was basically a stand-up comic who had done, like, some TV and movie work.
It's crazy to think of Michael Keaton as a stand-up comic.
It is funny, like, and
that,
I would Beetlejuice, love it, to see that.
Beetlejuice is essentially just his routine.
He's like a Jim Carrey type.
Yeah, he's like a Jim Carrey, like running back and forth across stage and just like talking fast, throwing just random shit out there.
Like, I don't know how.
I mean, every time he has a character like that, he nails it. So it makes sense.
You can find his stand-up on YouTube, I believe.
The Tube.
It's funny how, like, back in the 80s and even, like, 70s to 80s, that there was a genre of comedy just called, like, physical comedy.
Slapstick comedy.
Right. Just, well, in the stand-up sense, that you didn't have to say clever, funny jokes. You could literally just be a goof on stage.
Yeah, and Robin Williams. Just, I mean.
Well, I would say he had an interesting blend in the 70s, 80s, where he had, like, his physical comedy aspect mixed with some very problematic in the sense that he's so batshit crazy on stage that you kind of let it go. But like Jim Carrey, who literally, if you look up a Jim Carrey like bit, he literally for like 10 minutes, he just does impressions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, but hilarious. There's no joke. He literally just like transforms his face to Clint Eastwood and people laugh. And I'm like, that's funny. Like to them, that's very funny. To me, I'm not like, it's like, okay, like that's,
well,
but we're so used to like more like, you know.
Stuart, we all know impressions are very funny and we know the people who do them are very cool.
Oh, Stuart. You love how it went silent there from two of your friends.
Ominous.
Staring
ominous.
At you. I hope the audience could feel the eye rolls that just happened.
Stuart, can you prolong that gap in the edit? Make like 20 seconds.
Make it a 20-second long gap.
But everyone seemingly had a lot of fun making this movie.
I read in the trivia bit, and I would have died to be there on set, that when he first steps on like the soundstage or whatever to do his part, Michael Keaton, that they're chanting juice, 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 juice. And I was like, oh, my God. Can you imagine that? Like, that doesn't happen today anymore.
The thing that I love about this movie is that Beetlejuice is barely in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
He's like not, he doesn't appear until like 45 minutes in. And then he's in like 3 scenes.
Well, like there's another thing.
He's
says
like
how many
he's
lines
the
he
problem
has.
To be solved.
Yeah,
this movie understands that Beetlejuice is perfect as like an object or like in like small doses. If this whole movie were
they
to
talk about him more than they actually show him.
If this movie were to star him and he was in every scene, he'd probably get exhausting. You'd probably get tired of it.
Yeah,
but it knows to just dole him out in the perfect increments. It's like the Jack Sparrow in the first Pirates movie, where that movie knows the perfect amount of Jack Sparrow to put in every scene.
Yeah.
Whereas then you watch Pirates 4, and he's in like every scene just screaming at the camera.
Yeah.
And you're like, make it stop!
Because he forgot his lines. This is how he did it.
Well, it's an hour and a half movie, and Michael Keaton's Beetlejuice is in 14 and a half minutes of it. Like, that's insane.
Yeah.
You feel like there's more after you watch it. You feel like you got a lot.
Because he leaves such a huge impact in the film. Yeah. Because it's like, when he steps onto screen, It's like, those are the scenes you remember. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what you walk away with the film. For being such a, you know, you said 14 minutes out of it, like a 2.5 hour movie. Like, those 14 minutes, they slapped.
Yes,
they
like, they're incredible.
They were fantastic. Like, his, when he first gets introduced to them, when they get shrunk down to the miniature, yeah. and he's doing this whole bit with them, and he's doing the impression, and he's, like, changed back into his yeah. shirt, and he's,
hope
like,
you're like
and he's, like, groping the wife, too. It's just, like, that entire scene is, like, that's what I remember from the movie.
And that's not even, like, the first time we see him. We see him on a TV ad.
Yeah,
because that's the first time we see him like do like the come on down the Beetlegeist or whatever yeah. and it's like I got the bio exorcist and it's just every time he's on screen like listen I maybe Michael Keaton true to form can just do that but like you cannot tell me he wasn't taking bumps of cocaine.
The
off
thing
the
is,
side.
No, that's like, why. That's no. why the films were more fun back then. Right. People were chanting people's names when they walked on a set. There was coke everywhere.
Everywhere.
Like, you want to talk about Caddyshack for a second? Like Caddyshack had bowls of cocaine at craft services for fuck's sake.
Absolutely.
Like
absolutely.
The old ways of filmmaking. I would love
you
to
would,
go back to that.
You would show up.
Back when the booger sugar was clean and not cut with fentanyl, like, I want to go back to that level of filmmaking, people.
Booger sugar
well,
was
my,
clean.
The ideal vibe of filmmaking is you show up, you hit a bump of cocaine, and then you wake up 3 weeks later, the movie's done. And you're like, wait a second.
Honey, it's
wait
not just one bump. It's a lot of bumps.
You're like, wait a second, we shot that thing?
The thing is, like, that's how old Hollywood worked. Just saying. If you didn't know that, like, look up any, like, talk to anyone, people who worked in the 80s and the early 90s. Like, coke was, like, available on set as, like, a craft services dish.
And now we actually need money for our jobs.
And now I'm like, now coke is so expensive. I can't afford it. I have to actually work for it.
Yeah.
It just production just doesn't give it to me anymore.
The craft service has really gone downhill since then.
If you or a loved one has an addicted personality.
Well, you guys will be shocked to hear there's only one person who seemingly had a bad time making this movie.
Tim Burton?
No, take a wild guess. Who
Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
complained about this movie.
Oh,
why?
My God.
My favorite thing about Alec Baldwin is that he complains about every movie he's in.
Guys, I don't like this movie.
He is retired from public life like 3 times. And then just gets back on Twitter and starts tweeting at people aggressive things.
He probably runs out of money.
Yeah, he runs out of money. And then my two favorite Alec Baldwin stories are...
oh, I have a great one.
My first favorite Alec Baldwin story is that, you know, he talks like this in movies. He's always whispering.
Yeah.
He actually whispers in most of his movies to a level that his co-stars can't hear him.
Wow.
He knows that he sounds best when he whispers.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, he tells the sound mixer, I'm going to be whispering. And so they just boost his levels. And so he sounds the same as everyone in the movie. But on set, he's basically just like, this is not good. What's going on with the Beetlejuice here?
So one of my favorite Alec Baldwin stories is, so I have a friend who was a childhood actor. He's now a first assistant camera working in Chicago. Mm. And he starred, well, he didn't star, but he was Alec Baldwin's son in the movie Ghost of the Mississippi, which was starring Alec Baldwin and Whoopi Goldberg. My friend has the derpiest face. I love him to death. But there's a shot of him when he's having this conversation with Alec Baldwin as his son. Mm. And it's just the look on his face is still the same look he has today. And he ends up saying he ends up saying shit or something like that in front of Alec Baldwin. And yeah. just like the relationship between Alec and him is just absolutely hilarious. And then he got offered to work on Rust when Rust started shooting again.
No
and he turned, luckily he turned it down. But yes. I would have been like, you should have done it because you could have walked up to Alec Baldwin and been like, hi, Dad. and just see if he still remembered him.
My God.
Probably but apparently not. He had an entire spa day with Whoopi Goldberg. And I'm like, I want to hear all about that. Yeah.
Did you have a second story you were going to say, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. He's in Hunt for Red October playing Jack Ryan.
Yep.
And then they recast him for the sequel with Harrison Ford.
Better option.
Because he's just Alec Baldwin. And to this day, he still calls Harrison Ford an asshole and like refuses to ever talk or speak with him or be anywhere near him because he feels incredibly
I'm
upset.
Sorry. He should have been cast in the first one. I love that movie. Like, I love it so much. I've never read the book, but my brother's obsessed with the book too. But like, Harrison Ford would have been a better option for that. Sorry.
Why are you telling me that Indiana Jones took my role? Lemon. Let's delve into the movie. I think that's enough.
Oh, yeah, that's what we're talking about, right?
We are talking about Beetlejuice.
And Winona Ryder.
And Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
So, I guess we just talk right about the start of the movie.
Yeah.
It starts off with one of my things I love about Tim Burton is that he always does elaborate opening credit sequences.
Mm-hmm.
This one is just kind of.
That model is so.
The model's really incredible.
Yeah. Like, part of me, I rewatched it twice this morning and I was like, it can't be a model, right? And then I was like, no, it's a model the entire time.
Yeah.
Because the movie does, it's essentially what you think is a helicopter shot over the town the movie's set in, a small town in Connecticut.
Actually takes place in Vermont. I actually drove by the set of Beetlejuice 2 right when the writers went on strike because I was in Vermont that weekend.
Nice. They got so screwed. They had 2 days left to film it. Yeah, strike.
Beetlejuice?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So they got to go back and shoot 2 days.
I'm surprised they just didn't get a waiver.
It was a Warner Brothers, so they weren't going to get
one. They were on the strike.
But essentially, you think it's a helicopter shot over this town. Yeah. Which you're like, oh, wow, this is impressive, as all the names pop up.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Winona's like fourth build. It's like
Alec Baldwin,
Gina Davis. I think it's then Catherine O'Hara and then Winona? Or maybe it's Jeffrey Jones and Winona.
I think it's Catherine O'Hara.
I think it's Catherine O'Hara first.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
But she's, you know, pretty decently in there. For her third movie.
Yeah.
Is fun.
Yeah.
Of course, it ends with and Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice.
Yeah,
Because he's not the star of the movie, but he's the title character, so they're gonna give him the big one at the end.
Yeah,
he's also on like a lot of the advertising for it.
Yes, so. He's on all the posters, which is funny because you see him and you're really anticipating.
That's like
his
Zendaya
appearance.
Being on the posters for Dune and only being in there for 15 minutes.
Do you hear about the guy who sued that movie? Do you remember that movie Yesterday about the Beatles that came out a few years ago?
Yeah.
The World Without Beatles.
Oh, I think I know what you're
about.
There's
a trailer with
playing all the music, and he's like, this is new for everyone.
There's a trailer for that movie, which Ana de Armas is in, but then she's not in the final movie, and some guy sued, I can't remember whatever studio it is, because he went to go see it solely because Ana de Armas is in it. And I'm like, this is the horniest lawsuit I've ever heard
of.
Yeah. This man went to the theater with intentions, and he did not get them fulfilled.
And he did not get them fulfilled.
No.
But I have to ask, like, if that goes to trial, it's like that that defense attorney's gonna crush him.
I think
on
the judge dismissed it out of court
without standing. Sorry. So yeah, the beautiful title opening scene, and then also tarantulas do not exist in Vermont.
Yeah, I don't think tarantulas are a normal occurrence.
I literally was watching, and I was like, why is there a giant ass spider?
Giant spiders exist in Tim Burton's version.
In Tim Burton's Vermont. I mean, that town is absolutely beautiful. That part of Vermont is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. If you're ever there in the fall, I highly recommend it.
I would love to go up into New England for the fall.
Yeah.
But we get quickly introduced to our main characters, the Maitlands, Adam and Barbara, played by Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a bunch of, like, yuppies who move to the burbs. Small town, Connecticut. You know, they own a hardware store. And a big house on a hill, which looks crazy. It's like a very crazy house.
Yeah.
Mm. You expect that that's going to play into the movie, and then it's just kind of like they just live in a crazy house.
Yeah.
It just looks like that because it looks like that. But the movie does a good job of misdirecting you, because for the first like 15 minutes, it's basically just a movie about these two yuppies who are trying to not sell their house.
Yeah.
While he tries to build his model and she figures
they're
out.
They're finally taking a vacation from their busy life of running a hardware store in a population of 40 people.
I was going to say, is that what their jobs are? Like,
yeah, he runs the hardware store.
Oh my gosh. I was like, what do these people do to make
He runs the
house?
Hardware store that seemingly is open maybe once a week.
Yeah.
Because he just like goes down, opens the door, gets his stuff and leaves.
Well, they're on vacation. Remember?
Oh yeah, they're on
vacation.
They're on vacation at home.
Like, aren't you so glad we have vacation at home and not like Mexico?
Because they're planning on
almost would have been safer in Mexico.
Yeah,
they keep saying they're going to go on a vacation to like Sweden or something. I can't remember exactly. Where
I can't
they
remember
say.
Where it was.
But they're like, no, Europe. We're just staying at home to like finish up the house.
Yeah.
And so they go to the hardware store to pick up some supplies
for his model.
There's a good bit of foreshadowing where we just keep seeing this dog walking around.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, well, I hope they don't hit the dog. And don't worry, they won't.
The dog lives.
The dog does live.
Spoiler, they don't.
But on their way back, the dog runs in front of the car. They swerve and crash through a bridge.
I like that there was like a sliver of a moment where it's like, oh, maybe they're not going to die. And they die. It's not just like an instant they crash, the car falls, cut to black. Yeah. It's like they crash, they're dangling for a moment. They're like,
it's humorous.
Tim Burton does a great job of like taking things that could easily just be done like that, but adding a little bit of humor to it, and extending it a little bit longer to make it funnier, to like add more suspense to what's going on. Like he does that several times throughout the movie, and I think he does a fantastic job with that.
What I love about Burton, especially in his early years, is that he starts as an animator, and so much of his live action work is informed by that history and animation.
Yeah.
And just kind of how an animator, you know, does gags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, the concept of crashing a car through a bridge, you're suspended, and the only thing keeping you up is a dog standing on a single platform.
That's such a Looney Tunes car.
That's literally a Looney Tunes scene.
It is. Also, that river is not deep enough for a car to sink. I'm just throwing that out there as someone who's been by that river. But whatever. It's movies. It's movie magic.
And that's why, you know, we're going to talk about a few Tim Burton movies on the show. We get to avoid most of the bad ones, thank God. But, like, once he gets into the 2000s, he loses his cartoon sensibility.
Yeah,
because with this, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, even Batman, Batman Mars Attacks, those are all movies that feel like live-action cartoons.
Yeah.
Like, things just move in those worlds in the way that people don't move.
Yeah.
They move like a cartoon, like Beetlejuice is just a cartoon character who's found his way into the real world.
Yeah.
And so that's partially what makes it, this movie, like, right off the bat, so unique and so interesting. Is you are watching Looney Tunes, but in live action. And starring Alec Baldwin inexplicably.
Looney Tunes back in action. Brendan Fraser makes a cameo.
What if he did? But their car does plunge off the cliff, and...
they die.
They perish.
Well, we don't know that they die.
We just cut to them wet inside their house.
Yeah.
I should probably have phrased that better. They walk in, they're like, whoa, we're so crazy. What a start to our vacation.
And then they try to like get a fire going at the fireplace. And
but
then
it's already going.
It's already going. And sparks like fly off of Gina Davis's hand.
Yes.
And then Alec Baldwin's like, how do we actually get here?
Do you remember how we got here? And they're like, nope. And then they see a book on the table that said Handbook for the Recently Deceased, but a disease because Alec Baldwin's illiterate. And then they look in the mirror above the fireplace and they can't see themselves.
Yeah.
And then Alec Baldwin runs out the front door, gets trapped on, apparently it's Saturn. Apparently when I rewatched the movie, like the Saturn sandworms, that's what it is.
Oh my God.
Beetlejuice is like, I've been to Saturn too, and those sandworms are crazy. Like, so that's what it is. It's Saturn. So
good
he runs
know.
Out.
Good
eventually,
to know.
It was like 2 months, and like the passage of time in there is very interesting. Yeah. It's 2 months of him being on Saturn and her just being there alone.
Right.
The thing that, if I have one complaint about this movie, and it's not a complaint because the movie doesn't take itself seriously, is that the rules of being a ghost are so ill-defined in this movie and what they're able to do.
Yeah.
You can only see them. No one really can see them, but Winona Ryder can see them. But Winona Ryder can see them as, like, their actual selves. But, like, when you take a photo of them, there's no feet, but she can see.
No one can hear them except for when they put the sheet on, and then Jeffrey Jones can hear them.
Yeah, it's...
They can morph their faces. They can make a group of seven people do dance to the banana boats.
I work all night and I work all day.
They can turn shrimp into shrimp hands.
Yep. I like... If this movie was more serious, I would actually have a problem with that.
Yeah.
But because it is such a cartoon... You just buy into, like,
They're
cartoon characters and they can do these things.
Yeah, you just buy all the shit that they're
Mickey
able
Mouse
to
can take his eyes out of his head and throw them at you. That is the thing that cartoons can do.
Yeah.
I have no problem with it.
Which, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, his lack of seriousness, oh my God. Whatever. You know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
You can talk. I'm going to stop. Words are hard this morning. It is an early morning on a Saturday, and I obviously went out on Friday night.
Yes. Yep. And you had a great time by this.
Oh, I did. I looked fabulous.
You did look incredible.
I was wearing 6-inch heels, a beautiful dress, full-on makeup. I was living my Real Housewives fantasy.
My favorite thing was you telling us I'm dressed as a Real Housewife, and then me be like, I've never seen Real Housewives.
I've never seen an episode of Real Housewives, but it was a Real Housewives party that I was invited to, and I had to dress up. So, of course, I went all out as much as I possibly could.
You guys keep talking.
So, absolutely fabulous. Loved every second of it. But back to Tim Burton.
Yes. So they're dead. They figure this out, and they're just trying to kind of cope and understand,
like,
how to be dead in the world. the book, they keep talking about how the book is difficult for them to understand.
Which once again, it goes back to my, he's illiterate.
Because the second Winona gets it later, she understands everything in the book.
Yeah.
It's very funny how much they're just like, I don't understand anything that's going on in this book. I can't read it. I can't read the book. Just because they're now trapped inside the house, unable to leave, with no way of communicating with anyone or figuring it out. There's just a passage of time that occurs. We forgot to mention at the beginning of the movie, it's established they have a friend, a realtor friend, who's constantly trying to convince them to sell their house.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing she sees that it's like, you make a big profit off of it. She mentioned that there's a big, you know, wealthy New York City family
that wants to buy it. It's like $230 cash. Like,
yeah.
And then she's like, this house is so big for just like, for you two, like, this is meant for a family. Because they're not having kids. They don't want kids.
There's like the subtext that Gina Davis is incapable of having kids.
Yeah.
The movie never really mentions it again. But that's kind of thrown off. It kind of builds into this idea that Winona becomes their kind of surrogate daughter at the end of the movie.
They do kind of take her in because it's like...
They do.
Because she's unable to understand the book. It's like... Mm. You know, it's the children teaching the parents something.
Yeah. It's a nice subtext. The movie kind of forgets about it for basically an hour in the middle, but it is a nice kind of close, you know, loop to that story that she can't have kids, and at the end, you know, finds a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So the house gets sold.
Which she definitely relates more to than her stepmom in the movie.
Yes. So while they just kind of hang out in the attic with their model. And that's how they lived their lives for 2 months, including going outside and getting suckered by a sandworm. After those 2 months, they see their realtor friend come by after the funeral and kind of look at the house, and then another car pulls up with, which is the new home or the new family that's moving in, the Dietzes. Catherine O'Hara playing, what's her name in this movie? Catherine O'Hara playing Delia, Delia Dietz, which is a great name.
Who is like this like wannabe artist.
Yeah.
Who's like this sculptor person who like is this like New York upper class because she happens to have money. She probably married rich and is like, I want to just be an artist, and is like making absolute fucking garbage.
Yeah, that's the thing that I like about, because movies are about a lot of things. Movies aren't just like about one thing. I like that this movie is also just subtly this like snobs versus slobs 80s movie about like the real folks having to deal with all these, you know, trendy artist types trying to move into their house.
Oh, aren't they the worst?
They're terrible in this movie.
They're awful.
They make me question my life choices. I'm like, God, am I like...
Are you Delia?
Jeff, I've seen your apartment. You're not close to Delia. You're fine.
I don't know.
I'm looking at the little camera art pieces, and those could be Beetlejuice horror settings. Yeah.
They move in. Delia, her husband Charles, played by Jeffrey Jones, and then their Charles's daughter Lydia. Movie never explains what happened to her mom, but just that she only has a stepmom who she hates.
Yeah.
As
per the usual goth child.
Yes, as per the movie requirement, you need to have a stepfather or stepmother who you dislike.
Yeah,
It's important. You know, you can't have a movie without it.
It's a can effect.
A goth kid with two actual parents, like, come on, what do they have to be sad about? Nothing.
Okay.
And right away, Winona really looks great in this movie. She steps out basically in like a morning gown with her hair spiked up, the full black dress.
Yeah.
Does she have a veil on in the beginning? I can't remember.
I think so.
Yes, I think she has the veil at the beginning.
She wears it throughout the entire movie. The first dinner scene,
she definitely has it on.
Yeah, she's pasty white with like sunken eyes.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be you, Jeff.
She's basically, yeah, she's basically made to look dead. Even though she is alive, she looks like a corpse.
Yeah.
In a morning gown. And right away, she just kind of, it's a confidence in her performance that we haven't seen yet in our previous two movies.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I'm glad you brought that up.
You get the feeling that this is, again, it objectively is the movie where she figures it out.
Yeah.
But you really get the vibe that like she came to set and she, after her experience in the first two movies, was just like, all right, I understand this character. I understand what to do. I understand the assignment and this movie.
Yeah. and she is unwavering in it.
Oh, she understood the assignment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because she does clock that she sees people in the window.
Right, yeah.
There's all this hullabaloo about Delia's statues, including the most Tim Burton looking statue of all time, which is like a leaf that's sunken in with claws.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's getting just swung around. It pins Delia against the wall.
Well, how did she make, did she make those statues? Did she buy them?
She sculpted them.
She's a sculptor.
I don't buy it.
Her agent hates her too.
Yeah. Her agent does hate her.
She is, calls her a flake.
Yeah. Which is just
three times.
Yeah.
Rough. Imagine rough. That's disrespectful of Catherine O'Hara. But, you know, I'm glad that she, you know, handled it with grace.
Yeah.
Lydia clocks that there's two faces in the window upstairs. Mm-hmm. And she's like, look, there's fate. Her Midwest accent's like really kind of.
What was that, Jeff Sweeney?
Look, there's faces. No, that's not it.
Is she from the Midwest?
She's from Minnesota.
That makes sense.
You can really hear the accent in Heather's.
Yeah, you can.
It's like when she's like, dear diary.
Dear diary.
But she starts suspecting that there's something going on in the house. The parents are much too concerned with this guy, Otho, who's an interior
How's
designer.
How's he related to them? Like,
he's the interior designer for her. Like,
for
that's,
Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah, for Catherine O'Hara.
Her and personal interior designer, who's also an exorcist.
Which is hilarious. There's a scene of them, once they renovate the house, there's a scene of them sitting on this extended porch with, like, the facade of one side of the building. It's like, he's like, I know as much about the afterlife as I do interiorating, decorating. And the dad just goes, it's like, okay.
It's so funny how terrible he is at design, but he just keeps walking around Otho.
Otho.
Of course, his name is Otho.
I've never had a client who matched my energy, who understood what I... Like, they're both insane.
Yeah.
But I love him to death.
So we get all this fun business for probably about like 10 to 15 minutes, which is just the Maitlands seeing what is being done to their house.
Yeah.
And desperately trying to figure out how they can prevent it from happening.
Yeah.
Because do they try and scare them first, or do they not try and scare them until after they consult with their caseworker?
I think they...
No, right when they move in, they try... So the caseworker's afterwards. So when they're doing the one he's doing when they're doing the walkthrough of the house and then she's walking around with the spray can, like,
you're
spraying
right.
things down.
You're right.
Like
yeah.
they're in the closet together with the head cut off, he's in the study with like
yeah.
her holding a knife with Alec Baldwin's head. Like, they're trying to scare her, but no one's seeing them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then they're like, well, eventually they go up to the attic when they're like, have you been upstairs yet? And they're like, no. And they start walking upstairs and like, oh, I forgot to lock the attic. And they run up past them. They get like a little, they're like,
little,
but all of
a
sudden
sound.
Now they can feel them.
They can feel
like
them.
Once again, this not understanding of how the ghost world works in this movie. Yeah.
Because Alec Baldwin at this point does take his head off.
He does. He's running up there without a head at this point too.
Yeah.
Door slams shut. They can't get upstairs. And that's how they start. And then eventually he puts his head back on. And then they read the book and they're like, if you need help, draw a door. And he's like, what does this mean? And then, oh my God, it literally says draw a door. So they draw a door, whatever. And then knock three times. Dun, dun, dun. And it goes into this ghost world in this insane thing. And then you meet their caseworker, who is this like old woman who's just constantly smoking. And she's like, what do you want?
I love the ghost world.
It is my favorite part of the movie.
I am, one of my favorite things in movies is when they take like a fantastical world, whether that be, you know, ghosts, fantasy, sci-fi, and just put like the most boring, obnoxious bureaucracy into the middle of it.
It's Sylvia Sidney.
Yes.
Who plays Juno, their caseworker, who's also...
She's Mars Attacks. She's the grandma.
Grandma. Yep. Yeah, she's the grandma.
I just love her character in that. Like, when the football team dies and they're calling her coach.
Coach,
and
I don't think we make it off that bus.
No,
you
really.
Don't say.
When I was a kid, I don't remember why, what, you know, capacity I saw the image in, but when they're in the waiting room, there's that one guy with the shrunken head.
Oh, is that... Yeah.
There's like a guy in a hunter's jacket who just has a shrunken head. That's
there's
on.
A witch doctor next to
yeah.
him, I think.
That really frightened me as a kid.
My mom showed this to me probably when I was like 4 or 5 years old. And I was on the phone with her today and I was telling her I was coming over and doing this. And she's like, I don't remember showing this to you. I was like, Mom, I was terrified of this movie. Like, I didn't watch this movie again until I was in college.
It's like the great type of quote unquote horror that can scare a kid.
Right.
But not like traumatically.
Yeah.
No.
It's well. Not like, you know, because also like the Exorcist.
Tim, like the Tim Burns scene where he's like, are you even scary? And he goes, is this scary enough for you? They don't even show his face. They just show the reaction of Alec Baldwin and his wife. And you see like these things come off of the forehead. You never actually like see the scariest parts of what's going on. Yeah. Like the snake is definitely a little scary. That's what scared me the most as a kid.
The snake scared me a lot as a kid.
It's very Halloween vibe.
Yeah.
Where it's like the type of scary that will like frighten you as a kid, but not, you know, scare you shitless. And when you're an adult, you mostly just laugh at it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I like how like bureaucratic this is. They have to wait for their number to be called.
And they waited like 6 months, by the way.
It's essentially the DMV for the dead.
Yeah.
Calling what number 1,576,320. Like, that's the number one of the numbers they asked.
Yeah, they pull the roll and it just keeps coming out for their number.
Yeah.
And so they go back and to meet their caseworker, and they wind up back in their house, except it looks like a Realm of the Dead now with Delia's interior design work through Otho.
Because they've been there for 6 months now waiting, so they have all this time to renovate the house. So it's a good, it's a great way to pass that time in the movie. It was brilliantly done.
Well, because then Juno says, you've been dead for like 100 years.
I was like, you're going to be haunting them for 100. You're going to be living in the house for like 100 and something years.
Oh, is that what
it is? They establish in the sequence that there's essentially 3 layers to being dead. There's your dead and your ghost, and then after 125 years of haunting, you can be done with your haunting and be allowed to leave.
So there are rules.
I love these.
And then the alternate is if you get exercised, you essentially are in like a floaty.
And that's
realm.
what that room is when they're walking down the hallway.
Death for the
and
dead.
And you see the guy who's like the janitor or whatever, the flat guy, and he's like, how do I look? I don't have mirrors here. I'm feeling kind of flat. And he's like literally like a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's this multiple layers to being dead. A lot of rules in this movie.
Yeah.
Some of them well-defined, some not. I do find it fun.
Right.
So after, you know, they get their caseworker explains the situation to them and says, if you want them out, you got to scare them out. At this point, the caseworker is kind of apathetic to their plight. They're kind of like, yeah, you just scare them if we're not too concerned about them leaving. Later, the caseworker gets more involved, says, all right, you need to scare them out.
It's because they're now, they didn't get really scared. Well, nothing worked. They got the book in their hands.
Yeah.
She's like, we cannot let this routine haunting expose the existence of the afterlife. It's like, then maybe don't let the two idiots be ghosts. I don't know what to tell you. And also, only 3 visits to your caseworker in 125 years? That's not fair.
Death sucks.
Death does suck.
Mm-hmm. Well, because then they also, in their first visit, they also mentioned Beetlejuice.
Yes.
Because they saw a TV ad before they went into the...
And she's like, don't say his name. And she like warns them against it. And she's she's like, he used to work for me. He's this horrible person. You don't want anything to do with him. Like, he's a parasite. Like, don't say his name. Never say his name.
Definitely not 3 times.
Definitely not three times.
I like that they say at one point that like, people who commit suicide wind up working civil service jobs in the afterlife.
Yeah.
And the implication being...
Is that she...
Well, not only her, but Beetlejuice as well. Because he's he used to be my assistant.
Mm-hmm.
They never really go into like what Beetlejuice was before he died.
Well, what Tim Burton told him is like, Michael Keaton, is that he lived in every time period, but lived in no time period.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where he changes his whole like look. And he's just
he's like, I've seen The Exorcist 37 times, and it gets funnier every single time.
Oh, my God.
So they're like, all right, we don't want to call this Beetle guy, but we got to scare them out. What's the best strategy? And their best strategy is, let's put sheets over ourselves.
Put sheets on and just, woo,
I'm a ghost. Pull an E.T.
And everybody thinks that somebody else is having sex.
Everyone's like, if you're going to do this kinky shit, do it in your own room.
Yeah.
Lydia thinks it's her parents having sex in the next room over.
And this is where we actually start to get into Winona Ryder as like the more of the main character of the film. Is this scene right here. I also want a Polaroid that shoots that quickly. Like,
So many Polaroids.
Like, it's just, I'm like,
she's like, like, pictures just popping out.
I would love that. Also, for it to develop that quickly too. Yes. Movie magic. And then eventually they talk and they bring her upstairs. They show her the model. They talk to her. She kind of gets an idea of what's going on.
Yeah, well, she's like, you can see us. And that's when she says her line. It's like something about fact of like, well, you see, like, ghosts and all are of the world, realm of the strange and peculiar.
I myself am strange and peculiar.
And she says it so well.
She's relishing it.
She
delivers all of her goth lines with so much power behind them. It is phenomenal.
Bathing in the river of Golgotha.
Yeah. She's very much
like
said,
she's on the river of Styx right now. She's
very much said, like, as an actress, the roles that appealed to her, especially in this time period, were like weirdos.
Yeah.
Like, she wanted to play Lydia Dietz. She wanted to play Veronica Sawyer and Heathers. Yeah. That's what appealed to her, not playing just like the girlfriend or, you know, the main character in a John Hughes movie.
Yeah.
She wanted to play kind of these weirdos. And I think that this is the first opportunity for her getting that role.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's really relishing it, and she really feels this obligation to do a good job.
Yeah.
Because this is kind of her shot, and if she misses it, she might not get another.
But she just feels so confident on screen, like, especially from the two movies we've already covered.
Mm.
Talking now about this movie, it's like it's night and day in terms of her confidence.
Yeah. In
level.
Lucas, she's like, she's good, but there's not a lot of confidence. She seems very nervous,
very stiff in terms of dynamic motion and stuff.
In this, she's very loose on camera.
Yeah,
she's phenomenal on camera. Mm. Every time she's on screen, she, like, slays.
We're all waving to Becca. You're like you said, Scott, they show her the miniatures in the attic, and can't remember what, like, really the rest of the conversation was other than just, like, we're trying to scare you guys.
They basically just loop her into the deal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And tell her what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. I do like...
And then I think the best line when they're saying, like, he's like, good luck with that. My father never walks away from equity.
The two lines that I like in the sequence are the line about my father never walks away from equity. And then when they're like, yeah, we tried to wake your mom up and scare. She's like, she's taking a ride with Prince Valium tonight.
Yeah.
And I was like, God, I want to be her mom, her stepmom.
With Prince Valium.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to, you know, if I ever get diagnosed or prescribe Valium, I definitely would like to refer to it as Prince Valium.
I don't think they prescribe that anymore. I'm pretty sure that's like a drug they only give you in a hospital now. I don't think you can take that at home.
I
it's like
know.
The cocaine at craft services. Sadly, the 80s took that away from us.
Yeah, well, Valium was definitely like in the 60s and 70s, like the housewife drug. Mm-hmm. So it's very much like kind of like not seen as like your usual everyday prescription mm-hmm. sort of thing. At that point, they'll just give you Xanax and Ambien.
Yeah. So after their two attempts have failed, which to them has implied Alec Baldwin taking his head off and then putting a sheet on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's kind of pathetic how bad they are at this.
Yeah.
I do like that, you know.
They've never seen a horror film in their entire lives.
I love how square they are.
Yeah.
I think that's the fun dynamic of this movie, is how square they are in comparison to how
like Beetlejuice.
Snobby. The Dietzes are.
Yeah.
It's the conflict between the two of them, and Lydia's kind of the perfect mesh of both.
Mm-hmm.
She's as weird as her parents, but with kind of the soul of the Maitlands.
Yeah.
And so she's kind of the moral center of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And after their two pathetic attempts have failed, they're just like, let's just call the Beetle guy.
Yeah, because they go to the miniature.
They definitely didn't listen to their caseworker at all.
Yeah,
they were like, fuck this woman.
They ignored their caseworker immediately.
And Beetlejuice, who is miniaturized form in like where the miniatures are,
yeah.
is like looking up at them. And he's like, you got to say my name three times.
He's basically like a hobo.
Yeah.
He like camps out in other hauntings.
Yeah.
Because he looks through the obituaries and he's like, all right, where I need to work. I got to work.
Yeah.
He's living on their model.
Yeah. So they say the name three times, and then Beetlejuice appears.
They say Beetlejuice.
And they get sunk down to the miniature, and that's where they meet him, and he does this whole, like...
He does his little intro
where he pretty much sexually assaults her the entire time
yes.
that they're down there. But
he's an old horn dog.
He's an old horn dog. And it's just absolutely crazy. I mean, I just love how the miniature set looks when they're down there compared to like it looks so good from when they do the helicopter shot. Mm. And then when they're on it, it's literally just like foam padding.
Yeah.
And it's just like definitely a Tim Burton vibe. It honestly just feels so nice to me compared to like this beautiful intro shot to then just like, oh, let's just throw a bunch of foam padding on it, call the grass.
Yeah. But eventually, like throughout their whole talk with Beetlejuice, they're kind of,
I thought you were about to do it.
Do what?
Don't worry, nothing.
Oh, well, when they're done talking to Beetlejuice, they kind of get the vibe that's like, Beetlejuice is not a guy that we really think we should trust. Let's say Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. And then they,
oh, no. Hey, how are you?
I set him up for that.
Hey, Stuart, you looking for a guest on your podcast?
Oh, my God.
How are you?
This is
Scott. So how you doing? Who are we talking about today?
We're talking about you.
Talking about John Travolta.
Talking about you, Beetlejuice.
Oh, great. Here, buddy. Let me tell you something. I got a great idea for a new show. It's going to be called Beetlejuice the Podcast.
Beetlejuice.
I'll be here every week.
Oh. Good.
I was this man's best man at his wedding. Is there a way for me to remove myself
from this
narrative?
You were Beetlejuice's best man?
Yeah, he was my best man. Best men. I had multiple. Genghis Khan, Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, my best men. All right. What are we talking about?
We're talking about your movie.
Where are we at?
At the part where they...
You know, I'm making a sequel.
Oh, yeah, you're making a sequel.
Called Beetlejuice 2.
Yeah. Beetlejuice 2.
Feels good to be back.
You know what? I think this bit's run blue. Beetlejuice.
I would like to remove myself from this narrative.
It's all right.
You got rid of
him. I got rid of Beetlejuice.
I was a little worried there.
Beetlejuice is getting a little bit too Beetlejuice for me.
He's getting a little too Beetlejuice for you.
Oh, wait. We just said it three times.
No, you're not in the sequence. There's a pause. There's an interruption.
If I say Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, something, 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 Beetlejuice.
No, there's interruption.
We've already talked about this.
We did have an audio recording from our lawyer earlier in this episode that explained it.
We did.
Yes. From our podcast lawyer.
So whatever.
Yes.
So they meet her and they freak out and like, we don't want to work with him. He's horrible. They eventually like get off of the model. He's trapped in the model for a little bit. And then what's next after that? I'm trying to remember.
They're just like fidgeting with the little.
Yeah.
Little
so they pitch to Beetlejuice that what they want, and he offers his services, but they're like, this guy's a creep. We don't want to deal with him. And who of us hasn't, you know, consulted a contractor and been really creeped out and been like, all right, I'm not going to work with that guy.
We're just going to do it ourselves.
I do like when he's pitching himself. Mm-hmm. He kind of goes through his they ask him for his qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I saw The Exorcist 167 times, and it gets funnier every single time. I lived through the Black Plague and had a pretty good time during that.
Oh man,
it's just it's like this movie needs this jolt of electricity, like 45 mm-hmm. minutes in.
Because yeah. It is kind of relatively slow-ish going up to it,
right?
And not that it's become boring, but like the gimmick of two ghosts trying to scare a family, it's not really sustainable past this point.
Right, they need a little bit of juice to it.
Yeah, you literally need to add the juice to the movie.
You need to add the juice.
Add the juice!
This
is where the cocaine comes in handy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely plenty. So they kind of run away from him. They say his name again three times and leave.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, coming in for dinner? Hope you like Italian. And then turns around, they're not there, and he's pissed.
God, you do a really good Beetlejuice impression.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was just here. He was just here in the studio. It's not hard.
Yeah.
When he's here. Whoa. vicious assault happening.
Yeah. So then, they're not trying, like, the face thing yet, are they?
No. That's later on when they eventually go back to the caseworker.
Yeah.
When the caseworker actually summons them this time. This is the
Deo table scene, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is where we're going.
This is, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, God. I love this scene.
This is when they're like, we have a great idea for how to do this. And the whole time Lydia has been telling her parents, like, yeah, there's ghosts in the attic and I'm friends with them. And they're like, that's nice, sweetie.
Yeah. they're like, maybe you need to be on some kind of meds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe you need the Valium.
And so they have
this dinner
with their Otho.
Their interior designer and
her agent?
Her agent and his wife?
Yeah, and his wife and then Otho's wife. And the very weird, this ends very weirdly, but like,
Otho has a wife? I thought he was gay.
Yeah.
I thought he was a single
bachelor. Well, there's like this one woman who's with him.
That's right. And it's kind of weird.
Yeah. They have like a weird dynamic.
She doesn't matter. She added nothing to the plot. But this insane dinner that she's trying to cook.
And yeah, so Lydia's trying.
No!
Yeah.
Sorry.
That song just starts playing and Catherine O'Hara starts mouthing along to it. And everyone at the table is like, oh, she's so funny.
And then everybody else starts to like kind of unpromptly dance to it.
Yeah.
And
the scene's great.
Perfect pitch.
Yeah.
It's a really fun bit of choreography.
Daylight comes and they wanna go home.
I would really like to know, in Alec Baldwin's mind, what was the scheme here? because it's like, all right, I know how we're going to get rid of them. We're going to make them all dance to the Banana Boat song.
Yeah.
Like if I...
Which just goes into the fact that like they have no idea what they're doing. Like the fact that they threw on sheets and was like, this will work. It just kind of plays on the fact that they're just two idiots who have no idea what they're doing. And they're so square. And they're like, oh, this song is so edgy and whatever. It's going to scare them off.
Yeah, and they think it's a great idea.
Let me hit you with a pitch. If they have the ability to control them, because that seemingly this is a possession. They can possess these people.
Yeah.
Just walk them out the front door.
No, they can't leave.
Well, you just walk them out the front door, like to the porch, and then to like kick them.
Yeah, but I remember that after this entire scene, they run upstairs and they're like so giddy. They're like, "We got them!" And then they're staring out the window.
They're
like,
gonna be running out of the door any second,
and nothing
comes. Happens.
And then eventually, when Underwater comes upstairs, and it's like they want to talk to you downstairs.
They really want to talk to you.
And they're like, "Why?" And they're like. They want to make money off of them because that's the type of people they are. And eventually they don't come downstairs because they're like, this doesn't work. I'm not going to go downstairs for this. I want him out of my house. And then her agent leaves and she calls her a flake like several times to her face. She's like, I have consistently lost money on you. Like I am done being your agent.
Yeah. So then eventually they go back to their caseworker, I think, after this. And they're like, okay, so we... And their caseworker eventually says, like, oh, my God, you fucking idiots. basically saying it's like, whatever you guys have to do, like, you just have to, like, scare them, okay? Like, you're not thinking big enough, okay?
And you need that book back because Ortho now has the book.
Oh, they have the book after that? Oh, I didn't realize that.
Because she brings that up in the meeting and they're confused. Like, oh, my God, we lost the book. And this is where we get the quintessential Tim Burton prosthetic makeup vibe to it.
Yeah.
When Alec Baldwin stretches his face out and his wife
contort their faces.
And it's so well done. And because it's a practical effect, it holds up. Like watching it this morning, I was like, this looks phenomenal.
It
this
looks
was
really like good.
Any kind of CGI in the '80s, early '90s, it would look so bad.
Yeah, he essentially stretches his like mouth and nose and face like out to a point, and she like essentially stretches out her jaw, opens
and adds
it up,
like 8,000 teeth, and
pushes
her
eyeballs
inside
her mouth. Like
it's so well done, and it's just like whoever Tim Burton hires for his like costume and prosthetics, like.
Good
Oscar worthy. Like phenomenal, and it holds up so well.
Did this movie get anything like award wise for that shit?
Yes, it did. And we'll talk about that at the end. But the thing that's fun about the stretchy face is that Tim Burton very much didn't want this to look realistic. He's like, I want this to look cartoony and silly like the B movies that I grew up with. Like playing on Surround Our Spaces and whatnot. And so that's what I find so charming is that a movie like this can, you know, there's such a focus on like everything has to look realistic nowadays.
Yeah.
Like when you put, and I'm, you know, there's movies that don't do it, and I'm not blaming VFX artists for this, but there's such like this focus on make it look realistic, make it look like how this thing would look.
Yeah.
And kind of moving away from the fact like it doesn't have to look realistic. It can look just like Alec Baldwin's stretched face. It can look goofy. It can look cheap.
Right.
As long as it looks good.
Yeah.
The good and real are not the same. It's, you know, good is the opposite of bad.
It's also a movie, so you're allowed to play with that kind of stuff.
You can be silly. Make things look insane.
And so they come back to their house, and the first thing, I think it was Lydia, who at this point in time is writing like a suicide note.
Yeah.
Because she...
I have fallen. No, I have... plummeted off of the river bridge.
Yeah, and so she's like connected with the Maitlands, and it's like she's connected with them.
Yeah,
that she sort of sees them more so as better like parental figures than mm-hmm. her mm-hmm. dad and her stepmom are.
Yeah, absolutely.
So she wants to like die to go into the be a ghost yeah. and be
she
with
wants
them.
To join them.
Yeah. And so then they come back into the attic. Lydia then goes up there too, I think. And then she's frightened of them. And she's like, why are you guys doing this? Like, what the hell?
And oh, you know, she gets frightened because Tim Burton gets loose again. Oh, sorry, Tim Burton. Beetlejuice gets loose again and does that whole snake scaring scheme. And it wasn't their fault. And like that whole snake scene is Beetlejuice. It's not the mainland.
I think that's afterwards, though, because isn't it like she gets scared of their contorted faces at first, and then they drop the act with their faces. And they're like, clearly what we're doing is not working. Yeah, yeah. We're going to summon Beetlejuice. So they say Beetlejuice's name three times, Beetlejuice, 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 and nothing. Okay. I guess we're fine. So then Beetlejuice comes out and he immediately, I can't remember what he says before he turns into a snake. Some crazy bullshit.
Oh, you thought I wasn't coming back. I heard you say it.
Oh.
Thought I'd sneak in
so
here.
So he turns into like this rattlesnake thing.
Yeah. How are we doing? What scene are we on?
And scares the crap out of Winona Ryder. And Winona Ryder
we're
like,
on the snake.
Like,
that's one of my best
guys.
Bits.
Because it's really cool because he turns into like the railing of the stair kind of yeah. that then when they
it's touch, an old Beetle classic when I did that.
And then when he touches it, it like actually moves.
Yeah, and like
touch
this is like
when
this
I
is the this
it.
Is like
oh
the,
yeah, when I'm like the snake.
Oh,
oh.
I like that. I
this is like the great like Tim Burton animation style of like him mixing in this very practical effect.
Cartoons! I was cartoon once.
Yeah, yeah. This practical cartoon
it's a great show!
And the snake
and Beetlejuice,
like,
Beetlejuice, music, get out of here.
I got rid of him, thank you. And the snake, like, full-on, like, assaults them.
They
because
it,
the snake's, like, throwing them across
the
room.
Yeah,
the
snake
room.
Throws the dad down the stairs and scares the crap out of Winona and throws the mom into a bedroom or something like that. And throws Ortho, I think, off the staircase or something like that.
And I think it's Gina Davis who sees all this happening. She's like, what the fuck? Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. And then he goes back into, like, his realm or whatever.
Yeah, and she blames, and Winona blames.
Yeah.
The maidens.
So Ortho and the rest of the family, they're like, okay, so we have this book. Like, can you find a way to, like, summon them or whatever? And Ortho's like, I think I can figure this thing out.
I think I can figure it out.
Yeah. So
I know as much about interior decorating as I do the afterlife. Like,
so, yeah, and so he says, like, I need something very important to them. And that's when they find it very early in the film. So they call back to it where it's like the wedding dress and the wedding tux or whatever. So they put that on the table and they have like a summoning circle, essentially. Winona doesn't quite know what's going on. She's like, what are you guys trying to do? And then Ortho does the Incomi Domino Patris Filii Spiritus Sanctus. And so then they're in the attic, but they start to slowly fade away.
Ortho thinks he's doing happening? A seance.
Yeah, but what he's doing is an exorcism.
He's accidentally doing an exorcism.
Yeah.
Just a normal thing to accidentally do.
Accidentally do that, yeah.
And it further plays into the fun dynamic of this movie of like snobs versus slobs, like these kind of square, you know, suburbians in conflict with this, erudite city folk
who think they know what the fuck they're doing whenever they do things because they're, you know, the upper class
and neither of them fully understand anything. And it's just a fun dynamic to put them in. It's like it's very similar in dynamic to Ghostbusters.
We missed one scene. It was after the Beetlejuice attack and before the summoning, where Lydia goes up to the attic and Beetlejuice talks to her and tries tries to get her to say his name. And he's like, just to get the his energy of this is like he pops up like a bug, like a beetle, and she's like a bug, insect. Crawl, beetle. It's like,
yeah.
Okay.
Play charades.
Second word.
Because he's not allowed to say his name.
Right. He can't say his
name.
And
then she shows the thing of orange juice, and he's like,
it's like orange, breakfast drink. And he's like, no, you're so
beetle
close.
Breakfast, beetle drink. Beetle.
Like, definitely
and I'm just like,
toying with
right.
Toying
I'm like, girl, it's juice.
But then she kind of catches on. It's like, wait. And she's like, oh, it's juice. And he's like, yeah, your name is Beetlejuice? He's like, yeah, just say it one more time. It's like, you were the snake, weren't you?
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't know about this. I think I'm going to go
And luckily
back.
She sees through it enough at that point. But she obviously gets befit. I don't know the word I'm looking for. She gets fooled by him later on because, yeah, you know, she almost marries him at the end. Yeah.
He pitches to her, "I will free the Maitlands if you marry me."
Yep. Because they're now trapped in this exorcism thing.
And, you know, it's she really chooses them as her parents because she agrees.
Yeah.
To spend an eternity with Beetlejuice to save the Maitlands' lives.
Yeah.
From being damned.
Why does he need to marry her?
I think he just wants to be married.
To a little girl.
I don't think it has anything. That's the wrong father in that movie. To be
he
married.
Wants to marry a child.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Arranged marriage, by the way.
It is.
Yeah, an arranged marriage. With
to a, what, 14-year-old? 15-year-old? Yeah.
16, I think.
16-year-old? 16-year-old? So, yeah, you get that scene. And that beautiful red dress that she's wearing.
Yeah. Yes. But so then it's the exorcist scene. Yeah. And then the Maitlands then appear on the table wearing their wedding outfits.
Yeah, and they start
decaying. Yeah.
Gina Davis looks crazy when she's a full skeleton.
She looks nuts. And Winona immediately is like, "What are you doing? Like, stop this." And they all look at Arthur. It's like, "Can you stop this?" Like, I don't think I can, Charles. Because the dad's name is Charles. I don't think we ever said that. But it's the first time I thought, like, oh, X-Men vibes. Yeah. Like, it's too late, Charles. And at that point, then Winona runs back upstairs and calls. It's like, "Can you like save them?" And it's like, "You just gotta say the name. You know what the deal is." And she
says the name, and then Beetlejuice comes in and releases the Maitlands from their exorcism.
But we have to talk about like the first form he takes.
Yeah,
because he appears up as like a carnival thing.
Yeah. He rises out of the dining room table.
Like he's wearing a Ferris wheel top. Or not a Ferris wheel, like a merry-go-round carousel.
Like, "Oh, here I am."
And then he stretches out his hands, and we have the agent and the agent's wife, and he like lifts up his hands, and they're thinking, "Oh my god, it's a ghost. This is so cool. Oh my god, we're gonna make so much money." And then he slams his hands down and they go shooting up.
Yeah, he
like
hits the
fucking
floorboards, and the floorboards launch them into the ceiling.
Well,
and we
it's
never
like that,
see
it's
them
like the
again.
Carnival hammer game that you can play.
The implication being that the agent is played by Robert Goulet. The implication being that Robert Goulet is killed because he's launched through the ceiling and we never see him again.
Him and his wife
are both just gone.
They're just gone. Just probably dead. And so then Beetlejuice,
he disposes of Otho as well. Otho like tries to run away and he shoots a spotlight at him.
Yep. And he like changes his outfit from like a black to like light blue.
Yeah.
And then I guess Otho is so embarrassed by it.
Yeah, by his style change that he runs away.
That he runs away.
Because he likes wearing black.
Yeah.
God, what was I just going to say? Oh, we never mentioned specifically that Beetlejuice this whole time is marketing himself as a bio-exorcist.
I mentioned that.
Oh, did you? He'll remove the living?
Yeah.
This is his act, him doing his service.
Yeah.
Because he is a man of contract. He does do what he is contracted.
Yep. He was hired to remove the humans.
And so now that, you know, everyone's dealt with and the Maitlands are okay, he's like, "All right, let's get married." And then out of the fireplace emerges this like little guy,
the alien fuck.
Yeah, there's like he's it's clearly like a huge head, just prosthetic, like a Mickey Mouse Disney World style, because he's just like gong gong, like wobbles out.
And then Lydia is in a red dress and he's in like a little suit tux thing.
Yeah.
And he also makes the sculptures come alive and sort of grapple, incapacitate
the parents
because
he needs witnesses.
He needs witnesses, and so he's like, "Okay, let's go on." It's like,
it's more of that
Lydia
stuff, because I talked about this when they were in the waiting room. I love bureaucracy of a fantastical world that, like, even though this is like a spiritual guy event, he just literally has to follow the specific rules of the wedding.
Yeah,
and he needs like. There's like a little officiant alien. It's crazy. I love how
actual
specific
steps
this is
to do this. Like he has to follow the bureaucracy of all of it.
Yeah. And so then the alien is just like, "Do you, Lydia, take Beetlejuice to be your husband?" It's like, and then he's like, "I'll answer for her." And he covers her mouth. Yeah. It's like, yes.
And then he
mimics her voice.
Mimics her voice because that's one of the powers he's able to do. He's like, you know, it's a party trick.
It's like, "I, Lydia, take Beetlejuice to be my lawful wedded husband from Death of the Park, blah, 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 blah." And then he's like, "Okay, no, hurry, speed up, come on,
speed
let's
up, faster." Right. Because the whole time the Maitlands, now that they're coming to are trying to say his name three times to kick him back into the spirit world.
Yeah.
But he zippers Gina Davis's mouth shut and then kicks her out the door.
Yep.
And Alec, well, I don't remember what happens to Alec Baldwin.
He does something to Alec. I think he throws Alec Baldwin into the Saturn realm.
Yes.
Oh, he does. And that's when he gets like called by her again or whatever.
Oh, yes.
And he's riding the sandworm. And that's eventually how they defeat him, is he gets eaten by a sandworm.
Yeah. They ride this right before Beetlejuice is able to, what do you call it? Like finish the vows.
Yeah.
They blast a sandworm in through the door and eat him.
Yep. Yeah.
And he's like, oh no.
He gets eaten.
Yeah. And that's that.
Yeah, that's that.
By the sock puppet of a sandworm.
Yeah.
We then cut to black. We come back and we're at like a girl's school.
Yeah.
And Lydia runs out wearing like the usual like skirt and sweater.
She's not
combo.
Like all black.
Yeah.
It's almost like she's like de-gothitized.
She's letting some color into her life.
De-gothitized. She added purple and black.
It was just a phase. It was just a
it's
phase.
It's not a phase, Mom.
But she gets back to the same house. And are her parents there, or is she just now being raised
her
by
her parents
them?
Are there.
Okay.
Because she, like, the Maitlands are like, how'd you do in your test? And she's like, I got a B minus on my science test.
I'm so proud of you, sweetie.
And they're like, well, how about the math? She's like, I got an A. And they're like, oh, and they're so excited. They're parenting her. We cut to Jeffrey Jones and Catherine O'Hara in the other room.
Yeah.
I can't remember specifically what their interaction is, but basically like, they're kind of co-parenting this child between humans and ghosts.
Basically, yeah.
And she's like now the perfect mix of the two of them. She like has the weirdness of her parents.
And then she has the squareness of the
with some
parents.
Of the normalness of the Maitlands.
Yeah.
She's a product of the city and the suburb and is ready to go into the world.
Yeah. And then she's like, can we do the thing?
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, we can do the thing. And then she levitates.
Yeah, and is dancing to Shake,
Senora.
Take your body right. And
like
so
down the staircase.
Yeah.
That is the original ending of the movie.
Wait, there's an ulterior ending?
Well, the one that you guys, that we all watched is the actual end of the movie, but like the movie originally just ends with her dancing.
Yeah.
And then they started doing test screenings for the movie.
Yeah.
And it was so wildly popular and successful. And so both Burton and the studio were like, we need to show that Beetlejuice survived.
Oh, because
the movie just ended with him getting eaten by the snake, and that's the end of it. He's done.
Right.
And so they went back and they reshot and added that scene
where he's in the waiting room.
Where he's now in the
waiting room. He's like,
his number's like 9 billion something.
And they're serving number 3.
Yeah. And he looks next to him, and number 4 is next to him, the witch doctor.
The witch doctor, yeah.
And so he's like, hey, what's that? The guy looks away. He swaps their number. He's like, oh, I guess I'm next.
And then the witch doctor like sprinkles some dust and is like, and wait, what are you doing? What are you doing?
And he shrinks.
Yeah, that shrinks. But that was a last-minute add-in.
I completely forgot about that scene.
Yeah.
To just to give the implication that Beetlejuice survived.
So and if they ever wanted to come back, which they obviously did to make a sequel.
Yes. And that's the end of the movie.
That is the end of the movie. That is Beetlejuice.
That is Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice is a good movie.
It was a very good movie.
Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice.
You guys you haven't said it the third time, and you interrupted yourself.
I'm not going to.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
Hey, I'm back! How are ya?
Stuart. Yeah.
Guess what?
What?
I like ya.
Thank you.
I think I'm going to bring you in.
Oh,
I'm
bring gonna, me in. To what?
Bring you into the death world. You want to marry me?
No, thank you.
You and me, buddy, against the world. Eternity.
I'm good, but I'm
going to introduce Becca to a very good divorce attorney. I don't know who Becca is, but I'd love to meet her. I'm looking for a bride.
Well, real quick, we just finished talking about your movie, Beetlejuice.
Great movie! You're talking about the sequel, the television show? Ah! Thank you.
I was going to ask him for some context, but...
he's gone. You got rid of him.
But yeah, that is essentially the whole movie. I really hope that they don't fumble the ball of what they succeeded on in the first movie, which was not overblowing Beetlejuice.
Tim Burton's directing this one, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Good.
So the joy of, like, this movie is very lovely. It's so much fun.
Yeah.
It's like the key to it.
Cult classic.
Yeah, it's like, it becomes a classic almost immediately. It's made for $15 million. It makes $75
million. Yeah.
Back in the day, if you made $75 million, your movie was a success. Nowadays, if you made $75 million, they would, like, fire 20 people.
And, yeah.
Because they probably cost $100 million.
A company would
make.
Go under.
Yeah.
But it's a massive success. It launches a lot of careers. Mm-hmm. Burton, off of the success, is able to get the budget for Batman that he wants.
Yeah.
The studio is originally telling him you cannot have Michael Keaton play Batman.
Which he then gets.
Yeah, Beetlejuice being Seth, they're like, all right, he's a movie star. He can be in Batman.
It's insane to me that he...
How he went from Beetlejuice to Batman.
Well, I was just saying, like, it's insane to me that he just got done working with Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice, has this movie that has Batman and the Joker, and didn't think to cast him as the Joker?
That's
the thing
fair.
That's fun.
He would have been a fantastic Joker.
Well, right. they cast our old my old roommate as the Joker.
Right, they casted your old roommate as the Joker. I don't know who would have been the Batman if Michael Keaton was the Joker, but... Like, I'm just thinking, like, you just got done working with this guy as this batshit crazy evil
like
demon
the
lord.
Joker would have been the perfect.
Yeah, it's like, that's just naturally what I would think. It's like, imagine the phone call Michael Keaton's going to get from Tim Burton. Like, Michael Keaton's like, get a call from agent. Hey, what's up? It's like, hey, I got Tim Burton on the line. He wants to talk about this Batman movie. It's like, oh, Batman. Well, I just got done working with a Beetlejuice. He wants me to play Joker. It's like, no, he actually wants you to play Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, what?
And that we're not going to talk about Batman, like, as an episode, but he like
for a
there
while.
Was so much fan outrage over him. He cast as Batman. They were furious, and the movie came out, and people were like, "Oh, he's good."
Yeah,
he was only in what one, two, how many movies?
He did Batman and Batman Returns,
and
The Flash,
and The Flash,
which came out this year,
and
that
Batgirl.
Nobody saw,
and Batgirl.
Oh yeah, Batgirl. We did talk about our secret copy of that movie.
We got a secret copy of Batgirl,
a movie that was made, finished, and then deleted.
Yeah. Lost
because
in the archives.
Warner Brothers wanted to take a tax write-off on it instead of release it.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, so
it would have done so well.
So many people's work just like was written off as a tax write-off. They just did it again with some Looney Tunes movie they
which
were
is
making.
Which is ridiculous. That's the...
They were doing a movie called Coyote versus Acme.
Yeah.
Which was like a Looney Tunes legal drama, which sounds so funny.
Yeah.
And it got great test scores, great internal reviews, and then Warner Bros. Is like, yeah, we're just going to write it off for $30 million.
Is that the industry we work in now, where it's like, it's just a gamble of the movie you work on? I mean, you're going to get paid, but it's
like,
a gamble
I'm
as
shocked
to...
that Heist 88 actually came out. When we were all on it,
yeah.
I was like, this is not going to come out. And it came out, and they cut out so much of what we shot, and now the movie is like kind of trash.
Unwatchable. Yeah.
Like, they never filmed the last scene of the movie. So... So they just added a voiceover, and then they cut out this like entire side story arc, and now the movie's only like an hour and 40 minutes. And it's like,
oh my God,
what the hell? But if you want to watch Heist 88 on Paramount Plus, it's available for streaming now.
It is available. Check it out. Scott worked on it.
I did.
Are you in the end credits?
I am.
Oh, yeah.
I am in the end credits. The end credits go by so fast. It's because it's a made-for-TV movie.
I love when there's like, dude.
It's horrible. I was like hoping for the full scrolling.
Yeah.
And my mom literally called me after she watched, and she's like, I had to go back and rewind it three times to be able to find your name because of how fast it was going.
Wow.
And I was like, I just want to be on a movie one day where it's like the
get
big,
the scroll.
Slow scroll of the thousand
I
people who worked on
there.
It.
Yeah.
It would be nice. I want that one day. But this movie comes out. It came out in March, weirdly.
Interesting. Because March seems like a September, late summer, early Halloween movie.
I guess like, yeah, it feels like a, it has very autumnal energy.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it comes out in March 30th of 1988.
That's so weird.
Interesting.
Massive success, as I said, financially. Gets great reviews. Yeah. This movie is, no one complains about this movie.
Yeah.
Except for Alec Baldwin. Everyone is thrilled by it.
Because he didn't get to shoot anybody.
Yeah, he didn't get to shoot. He has to wait a long time for that.
Whoa. Sorry, too soon. he really wanted to shoot Tim Burton.
Yeah.
But no, he's this movie just it does
it
well.
It sets off a lot of careers.
Yeah.
So Winona, Burton,
yeah, because
Keaton.
It gives Winona so much clout going mm-hmm. in. Mm-hmm. You know, her next movie that we're going to talk about is 1969, which isn't impacted by this because they kind of shoot around the same time.
Yeah.
But, you know, from Heathers onward, her career is defined by being Lydia Deetz.
Absolutely.
It's probably one of her top three iconic roles in terms of what people remember her as, recognize her.
Right.
And so it really does go on to the rest of her career. And, you know, we're going to keep talking and cycling back to Beetlejuice when mm-hmm. we talk about the movie she's doing.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing this movie does is get an Academy Award nomination and win for Best Makeup.
Yeah.
Yeah, as it should.
Well deserved.
Well deserved.
It also launches, weirdly, a kind of
mini
franchise.
Do you know who it up was who was against in the category?
I can find out. I'm pulling it up right now. So this movie is nominated for Best Makeup at the 61st Academy Awards. It's up against Coming to America and Scrooge. So this is like a very easy win for that.
Oh, absolutely. I know the DP who shot Coming to America.
Really?
He shoots Force.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's Jody.
I did not know that.
Yeah, he also shot the last couple seasons of Empire. Really good guy.
Hmm, that's cool.
He doesn't have his full name on the slate. He literally just has DP.
DP.
Jody.
DP Jody.
Yep.
That's a sign of, you know, clarity.
Mm-hmm. Great guy.
This movie weirdly launches a kind of mini franchise, because off of its success, there's an animated series that airs on ABC. I'm trying to figure out how many seasons this aired for.
I think it was 2 or 3, right?
4 seasons. Wow. No one reprises their role for the animated movie, but it does star all the same characters. Remember back in the 80s was a weird time where like a comedy we've made that's like kind of catered to adults, and they would just make like Ghostbusters had an animated series.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot about how Ghostbusters is a movie that ends with a dick joke. Like, we need to touch tips, defeat the ghost.
Yeah.
And now they're making like all these irreverent sequels that are just like, remember when it was like to be a kid? And I'm like, no, I don't remember. These movies are about guys touching tips. What are we doing? Why are we making this movie? It's like, I found a Ghostbuster in my basement, and it's just the most incredible thing. I'm like, no, skip this bullshit. Just let me watch the guys fight the ghost.
Yeah.
But like, they made a Beetlejuice TV series. There was a Broadway mm-hmm. musical in the past decade.
Which I heard was the pretty good.
Beetlejuice is still touring. It's currently in Chicago right now.
Is it in Chicago right
now? Yeah, I just drove by.
You'll be able to see it tonight.
If we can find tickets, I'll go with you. Like, but it's done well. It's toured. I think it's been nominated for a few Tonys. Like, it still holds its nostalgia of that movie.
Yeah, got good response. It was nominated for Best Musical, Best Original Score, Best Book, Best Lead Actor for Alex Brightman playing Beetlejuice.
Mm-hmm.
So
he did a great job of it. If they have a recording of it when they did his Tony mm-hmm. stuff, he is a phenomenal Beetlejuice.
Yeah,
I might have to listen to some of the soundtrack, but it is. I think the musical partially is what inspires them to kind of go back, because Burton always wanted to make a sequel to this movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The pitch was originally Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian. That was the movie they
what?
Kept. That was
Serves up. Oh.
That's what he wanted to make. It would not involve Lydia Deetz or any of those characters. It would just be Beetlejuice goes to another family in Hawaii.
No.
And it would be called Beetlejuice
way.
Goes Hawaiian.
Wow.
And he came very close to making it multiple times.
Yeah.
But never quite, you know, crossed over finally into making it.
God damn, that's so funny.
Burton's actual quote about that was, he said it would be funny to match the surfing backdrop of a beach movie with some sort of German expressionism.
Fuck it, I want him to make it.
Oh, apparently it did still involve the Deetzes, but they moved to Hawaii.
Beetlejuice 3.
That should be Beetlejuice 2.
Do we
it
already know what the plot to Beetlejuice 2 is going to be?
There has been basically nothing about what Beetlejuice 2 is.
I just hope that, like I said this earlier, but like, I just hope they don't ruin the thing that they did right in this movie, which is 14 and a half minutes of Beetlejuice in an hour and a half movie. Mm. Like, I really think this movie, like Beetlejuice 2, like, if, I mean, because we see it all the time with all the new reboots and sequels, right? It's like the thing that they did right, they do the opposite of it in a reboot, and it just tarnishes it. Like,
feel like Tim Burton is going to hold.
Yeah. Like, if it's Tim Burton at the helm, then it gives me a lot of good hope that he's not going to make that mistake. I would just, like, if it was a different director, I'd be so nervous of, like, they're going to, like, overuse Beetlejuice. He's going to be, like, the main character. He's going to be, like, Jack Sparrow 4, you know, where it's just too much Beetlejuice, and I get too exhausted in the first, like, 10 minutes of it.
Yeah, and he's a very abrasive character to have on the screen for that much amount of time. But, I mean, we'll see. I mean, they now can finish filming.
Yeah.
So
the last
maybe
2 days.
Two more days of filming. Probably they might honestly add some reshoots in because they had this
probably.
Much time.
Yeah.
To kind of edit the movie. As
So, I mean, we'll probably see it sometime end of next year.
It's supposed
probably.
To come out September 6th of 2024. When we will be doing an episode on it, because Winona is back in it.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah, they're coming back. This time with my actual second guest star.
He'll be
time.
Back.
Hey.
By the way, this is featuring Scott, which was never introduced at the beginning of the episode.
It was in the opening intro.
Sorry,
intro.
I wasn't here for that. I was too hungover to get here on time.
But I don't want to talk too much about Beetlejuice 2, because we will cover it.
Yeah.
And we'll have a great time talking about it, I'm sure. Hopefully it's good.
It will be.
I think that's, we've said our, do we have any final thoughts on Beetlejuice? Anything we wanted to say?
She served. I don't know.
She served. She knew the assignment. She gained a whole new sense of confidence. And you see that in the rest of the movie she's going to do.
And it honestly set up my love of Winona Ryder when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Even though I was terrified of this movie.
She's big first crush. As a young boy, this is like big first crush material.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Especially in this
movie. My young gay self was definitely obsessed with Winona Ryder. Probably for the different reasons than probably what I probably thought I was originally.
Yeah.
But I was definitely obsessed with her.
Well, we'll start picking up on her newfound, you know, fame and confidence starting next week when we talk about 1969, starring Kiefer Sutherland and Robert Downey Jr. and also Winona Ryder in a small role. But then the week after that, we really start picking up with Heathers. But for now, make sure to tune next week for 1969. We hope you'll enjoy it. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, you know, I'm going to bring a friend in to
Beetlejuice.
Close us out.
Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice.
Hey, I'm back.
All right, Beetle, buddy, I need you to bring us to the end. You remember the intro from that time we talked before?
Oh, yeah, I remember. All right, please, Mike, subscribe, review on whatever platform, or I'll come to you, and I'll bite your head off, and I'll rip your eyes out. All right, so like,
Beetlejuice,
review, subscribe.
Beetlejuice. But thanks for listening, guys. It was a pleasure.
Like,
for
review,
me.
And subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on. As a reminder, we are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and YouTube. Amazon Music. There's a bunch of others. You can pop to our Reddit, r/Trevolting. You can find us at TrevoltingPod on Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. Find me on Twitter at JeffWSweeney. Special thanks, as always, to Rebecca Johnson for our graphic design, Michael Van Bodegem-Smith for our theme music. We hope you had a great week, folks, and tune in next week for our episode on 1969.